The story I'm about to tell is from my book, Helitown, Oakland's History of Development and Displacement. From 2016 to 2018, five arson fires were intentionally set at residential construction sites in Oakland, California, and nearby Emeryville. They were lit at a point in the construction process when the rising wood frames had not yet been protected by a sprinkler system. In late November of 2018, a handyman, Dustin Bellinger, was arrested and eventually sentenced to 5 years in prison. The fire stopped, but a great deal of damage had been done. Developers had to start over, and the long delay in construction, alongside higher insurance and security costs, jacked up pricing for the 500 apartments. While most people decried the arsons, some applauded the destruction of what one Twitter user called gross, expensive condos. Smaller acts of vandalism, busting windows or spraying graffiti, the fires were the extreme end of a grassroots protest against building market-rate housing in a city experiencing a dire housing shortage. A new phenomenon was born, NIMBYism, not in my backyard, traces to the early 1960s and battles for local control over neighborhoods, under siege by grandiose plans, urban renewal, limited access highways, office skyscrapers. Over time, the battle for local control over neighborhoods, NIMBYism, burned most brightly in upper-class districts, an apartment building on or near a single-family street, a chain or franchise replacing a mom-and-pop store. Greater density, traffic congestion, and introduction of unwanted outsiders. Recent Oakland NIMBYism among the poor and working classes too represents a demand for local control over neighborhoods faced with disruptive forces. New market-rate housing is today's principal culprit because many fear that the introduction of more affluent residents will supplant those unable to afford Oakland's increasingly unaffordable housing prices. Other improvements to a neighborhood are also out of favor. Bike lanes, improved transit lines, better landscaped streets, cafes, yoga studios. Why? Because these accessories signal an influx of gentrifiers. The more educated and affluent, usually white and Asian folks, whose presence will lead to the exodus of Black and Latino residents who cannot afford the new housing equation. This NIMBYism aims to keep the remaining poor and working class of the East Bay unattractive to developers and gentrifiers. Better to have less investment, less improvements, less good services, since they would all lead to rising house prices and the need for people to relocate from Oakland inland toward the Central Valley. NIMBYism for the poor and working classes in Oakland appears committed to keeping the neighborhood torpor going and demanding an increase in the supply of affordable housing absent those marketplace mechanisms that are central to the nation's system of housing production.
Your book tells the story of Oakland struggling with deindustrialization, desperate for new investment, young enterprising people, racial integration, and real estate development. Yet in your opening remarks, Oakland is having a renaissance, but some people would prefer slum-like conditions to gentrification, economic opportunity, and change.
Oakland, early 20th century, was a period of great promise. Competition with San Francisco, the thought that, oh, the flatter, warmer East Bay would become the big city in the Bay Area, not San Francisco. It didn't happen, but Oakland prospered, industry came, there was a lot of growth of population, a lot of development of all sorts of buildings. And that culminated really in the Second World War, which brought forth the first large-scale migration of non-white people to Oakland. Oakland in 1940 was 94% white. From 1940 to 1980, Oakland goes from 2.6% Black to almost 49% Black. They came for the war industries and to get out of the South from Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas. The tragedy of the post-war years is deindustrialization. Shipbuilding, automobile assembly, canneries moved out of town or they moved overseas. Oakland lost its industrial employment. And a city that's half Black has high unemployment levels and the corresponding urban ills that go alongside those. When Jerry Brown was elected mayor in 1998, Brown's strategy was to bring in affluent residents and revitalize downtown and hopefully then start having spin-off effects in the rest of the city. It went all too well. Home values have skyrocketed. A house like I live in the Oakland foothills, you could have bought it in 1995 for about $250,000, and now they're running over $2 million. Rents have gone up correspondingly. The city has become very expensive because of the proximity to San Francisco and Silicon Valley. A lot of businesses moved from San Francisco to Oakland, including PG&E, Blue Cross Blue Shield, the Sierra Club, Sunset Magazine. A lot of architects and engineering and planning offices moved to Oakland because San Francisco was so expensive. And similarly, residents were moving to Oakland during the same period. I myself moved in 2002 from San Francisco.
Your description of Oakland reminds me of the Brooklyn Renaissance, which may be apt since many of our listeners live on the East Coast. Brooklyn didn't have many new office buildings. It was run down. There was white flight to Long Island because of poor public schools and crime. I moved to Brooklyn Heights after college in 1987 and lived there for 5 years. It was just two subway stops from Wall Street and Solomon Brothers, and the rent was much cheaper than the Upper East Side. Kay Heimowitz spoke on this program about gentrification of Brooklyn, and this is where young people want to live. Can you imagine if the community had prevented Brooklyn's development? Why would you want to celebrate arson of a new building? Why do you want to stop growth?
The conundrum is that the people who can't afford the new housing in Oakland, they feel they're being pushed out. And there's a lot of anger toward that. Oakland's really inherited political radicalism from Berkeley and somewhat even from San Francisco. You have a strong left-leaning reaction against new development, against the kind of people that come into Oakland.
I was at my cousin's wedding last weekend in San Francisco, and there's a big homeless problem there. How was it in Oakland?
Homeless people, they've become omnipresent in the last 5 years. Tent cities located along transit corridors, under freeways, on top of parks.
Is there rampant residential construction given the increasing housing demand?
I read a statistic that for every 6 jobs that are created in the Bay Area, there's only 1 housing unit built. Our housing deficit grows and contributes to the rising prices, which make the Bay Area the most expensive metropolitan area. I have friends, one works at Facebook, one works at Rivian. They can't afford a house in Palo Alto. Once Palo Alto and San Francisco become supremely expensive, the overflow starts to move to the East Bay. Oakland's one of the logical places. The NIMBYs in the foothills and upper hills don't want denser housing in their neighborhoods. And now the poor residents in the flatlands don't want it because they see it's going to lead to gentrification.
Professor Ed Glaser spoke on what happens next. He's the departmental head of economics at Harvard. He pointed out that California used to allow residential real estate construction. California was the fastest growing state with average home prices. Today, there's little building because of zoning and other governmental impediments to building. Real estate prices are now sky high, and there's migration out of the state. Why has NIMBY, or not in your backyard, become the mantra of that state?
People arrive in California, it's beautiful, and they wanted to stay the way it was when they arrived. This is the case with a lot of people in San Francisco and Berkeley, and Oakland increasingly. California had a bill passed in 1972, CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which mandates environmental review for a whole range of projects. CEQA is wielded by the anti-growth forces to stop development or to scale it back by lengthening the process or by making it so difficult that people give up altogether. People are like, let's scale it back, let's go slower, let's preserve the neighborhood character, we like things the way it is.
Howard Husak spoke on what happens next regarding his new book, The Poor Side of Town. He mentioned the market-based solutions for building large-scale, affordable working-class bungalows in Oakland in the 1920s without government interference. What happened? Why won't locals allow land use in its most efficient way to create denser communities driving down price?
It's more than zoning. There's not a lot of land, buildable land. It's not like Houston or Dallas, which just goes on and on. And there's really no impediments. To get to the Central Valley, you have to cross a couple mountain passes. Then this whole process of suing and environmental review has lengthened the development process considerably.
Let's talk demographics. As you said, in 1940, Oakland was 95% white. By 1990, it was 44% Black, 14% Hispanic, 14% Asian, and 32% white. And 30 years later, despite the dreaded gentrification, the white population has actually fallen to 30%. The African-American population has collapsed from 44% to 23%. Hispanics have replaced African-Americans. Asians are steady around 15% over the period.
Cities change. They don't stay static. They change based on larger socioeconomic trends that are going on around them.
I was born in Chicago. Like Oakland, there was a major in-migration of African-Americans from the South during the 40s to the 60s. Chicago had been a white city, but after the white flight to the suburbs, Chicago population fell in absolute terms. African-Americans came to Chicago for jobs, physical safety, and the promise of a better education for their kids. But many didn't work out that well. Jobs disappeared, crime was high, with many homicides, and schools where kids didn't learn. Blacks are leaving Chicago in droves. For the past 20 years, 10,000 African-Americans abandon Chicago annually, and 800 are homicide victims. That is 1% of Blacks move away each year, and 1 in 1,000 are murdered. Meanwhile, Hispanics are moving to Chicago big time. There are now more Hispanics than Blacks in Chicago, and given birth and migration patterns, Chicago will be majority Hispanic in the near future. This Chicago experience reminds me of Oakland, similar ongoing Black exodus and a Hispanic influx.
I lived in Chicago for close to 5 years. I taught at University of Illinois. The similarities are there. Black migration out of the city for reasons of safety and better schools and better housing. Oakland schools have underperformed just like Chicago schools. If the Bay Area remains a very hot white-collar economy, in 20 years, most of Oakland will be affluent. It will transform, like Brooklyn has, to a greater degree than Chicago, because I think the forces are so much stronger in New York and the Bay Area. The working class are going to be pushed out.
Next topic, sister cities. Oakland was the rollover city for San Francisco, where land was cheaper and large swaths were zoned industrial. There are several examples of sister cities foundering. Gary, Indiana, Newark, Camden, and East St. Louis each went into long-term decline. Why have sister cities struggled, and what makes Oakland different?
Oakland is a combination of Detroit and Marin County in the same city. You don't see that in Gary or Camden or East St. Louis or Newark. Oakland was acting like the well-to-do suburbs, like Montclair. There's a neighborhood, similar population, similar types of houses, similar types of businesses. So it's a kind of combination city. And then you add to that equation Berkeley. None of those other cities have Berkeley right next to them, this intellectual powerhouse city. Innovations in architecture, in environmental policy, these are all Berkeley phenomena.
Berkeley is known for its leftist politics. Does this explain why the Black Panthers organization's roots are in Oakland?
The Black Panthers never would have happened if not for the proximity to Berkeley. It was that interaction between the student radicals in Berkeley and Merritt College, which was a community college in North Oakland, became the hotbed. That's where Huey Newton and Bobby Seale went, and that's where the Panthers began in 1966. So the synergy between Berkeley and Oakland makes Oakland very special.
Has there been substantial rioting in Oakland?
Yes, there was. I mean, it was nothing like the Los Angeles riots. The Los Angeles riots were harrowing. They occurred all over the city, block after block of burning. Each time there were police killings, there would be protests, peaceful in the daytime, and then when night came, there would start to be breaking windows of banks or stores downtown. The Occupy movement in Oakland in the early 2010s was the most militant. They occupied City Hall Plaza for months and months.
Next topic is property crime. I was in San Francisco last week and having lunch with a buddy of mine at an outdoor cafe in the nicest residential area in town. When my friend found out that I left my luggage and valuables in the trunk of my rental car, he was totally panicked. In San Francisco, the local district attorney no longer enforces property crimes, and criminals break car windows and take everything with impunity. It's to the point now where nobody leaves anything in the car and they keep their windows open. Better letting some rain than have a broken window. Has Oakland been ravaged by similar property crimes and a breakdown in its civil order?
There was an article today in the newspaper that certain people were having their mountain bikes stolen in the hills while they were riding at gunpoint. Oakland has had several TV news crews held up at gunpoint and they stole their cameras and video equipment. Crime is really bad around the Bay Area since mid-pandemic. But the biggest issue is that you have overzealous policing, right? Shooting black men all around the country. And so the Rudy Giuliani break no windows, that policing philosophy, I can't imagine that coming into play again with the legacy of police brutality. So on the one hand, you've got police brutality. On the other hand, you've got criminals operating wantonly. There's actually a recall vote for the district attorney, Chaza Boudin, the son of one of the Weathermen heirs. He's probably one of the more left-leaning district attorneys, and he likely will get recalled. We have an Oakland mayoral race in the fall, and I'm hoping, you know, there will be less tolerance for, you know, homeless tents everywhere. We're trapped in this kind of awful position between police brutality and criminals operating too freely.
New topic, professional sports teams. In the 1970s, sports teams were expanded to California, and the San Francisco MSA is the second largest in the state. I am sure Oakland rolled out the red carpet for these teams.
Around 1970, we had four professional teams. We had the hockey team, we had the Warriors, we had the A's, and we had the Raiders. There's no city of around 400,000 people that had four major league teams. There's none that had three. So Oakland is uniquely successful in building the Coliseum and Arena. That was the coup. The old philanthropic elite, Henry J. Kaiser, Stephen Bechtel, and others, they were behind it. We used to have that kind of old philanthropy in Oakland. We don't anymore. And that's a lot of the reason we've lost the teams.
Are other institutions packing up for San Francisco?
My college, California College of Arts, is moving to San Francisco and abandoning the Oakland campus. They're selling it after 100 years in Oakland. They're leaving Oakland because of that allure of San Francisco.
Universities rarely move. What's the backstory?
The school was founded in Berkeley. It moved to the Oakland campus in 1923. And in the 80s, they started design and architecture programs, graphic design, industrial architecture, et cetera. And they did it in San Francisco. The Oakland campus, which was more fine arts, has been atrophying. And I think the board shifted from the East Bay to the West. They decided to consolidate everything in San Francisco and leave Oakland behind because there isn't the money there. With CCA, my school leaving and the Raiders and Warriors leaving, the Oakland Tribune folded. We're becoming sort of like the residential and office suburb of the west side of the Bay. We don't have our own wealthy individuals who back things. And all these things are part of sad institutional decline in the East Bay.
Transportation. California is the land of the freeway, and Oakland has its fair share. In Chicago, when they built the Eisenhower Expressway, it cut the west side in two. City planning and freeways is complicated. What happened in Oakland?
Wow, we're the center of the Bay Area freeway network. Isn't this amazing? We have great freeway access, but at the same time, freeways really tore the city into lots of pieces. We built about half of what was proposed.
The next topic is slum clearance. Howard Husak discussed public policy where they cleared neighborhoods in industrial cities to build retail malls and to integrate white middle-class residents with lower-income African-Americans. We discussed the tragedy of destroying poor neighborhoods, and we specifically discussed the knocking down of a section of Boston. What happened in Oakland?
In Oakland, like Boston, Government Center and the West End was an attempt to basically sanitize itself and create a new environment for tourism and white collar and hotels and cultural institutions. Boston ends up with Faneuil Hall, the New England Aquarium. They basically eliminated poor people from central Boston. Oakland tried the same thing. They took out 18 blocks right in the heart of Oakland to build a huge shopping mall, five anchor stores, that was the goal, and surrounded by office towers. The shopping mall never happened because it was catering to white women from the hills and suburbs, and the stores didn't believe they would go to downtown Oakland. So the shopping mall failed. It was a really misguided effort. And of the office towers, very few came. They demolished 50 blocks for industry and this big urban renewal project called Acorn. And the goal there was similar. We're going to turn a very poor black slum lower-income Black slum into a middle-income mixed-race development that will provide a buffer for downtown between that and the rest of poor Black West Oakland, so that downtown can become like downtown San Francisco, this gleaming cultural office, white-collar district. Didn't work. The two biggest slum clearance, which was Acorn and City Center in downtown, were unmitigated disasters.
Next topic, museums and cultural institutions. In your book, you discuss how the white elite got run out of town. What happened?
The Bechtels and Kaisers banded together in the 50s alongside the Oakland Tribune, pushing for a consolidated state-of-the-art museum downtown, right on the edge of the lake. And they built an extraordinary building. It was a real triumph for Oakland to have this museum. But at the same time, it comes at that period when the demographics are changing so much. And the museum, you know, it's still a white institution serving the affluent whites. And it makes tremendous efforts to be a multicultural museum for all of Oakland. The last great project was the Oakland Ballet and Oakland Symphony. They took an old movie palace and turned it into a concert hall. And it failed. The Oakland Symphony didn't make it. And the ballet also has struggled. It's dark most nights. It's not functioning, I think, the way people would have thought when it was converted in the early 1970s.
Oakland now has a substantial Asian population. How has that impacted the culture of the city?
Chinatown is the model for a 24/7 district downtown. When I moved to Oakland in 1981, it was the only place you'd go at night in downtown because it was alive. There were people on the streets. Everywhere else, people went home after 5 o'clock. And then with the big migration starting in the late 70s, you started to get Vietnamese, Cambodian, Lao populations. It's been a boon to Oakland.
I currently live in Miami, and the town is booming. The cranes are out. I've actually never seen so much residential building. Yesterday, I heard a lot of noise. I looked over, and my neighbor's house was knocked down. Every house in my block will get bulldozed in the next few years. What's happening in Oakland?
It's not actively pursuing change. Within a mile of my house or more, I don't think there's a new building built in the last 45 years. Not one. Very little commercial building. The affluent NIMBY districts don't want development. They would freak out if you took out 4 two-story buildings and put up a 20-story high-rise. People love the Bay Area. You know, they talk a lot about how the Bay Area is special, how it's the most beautiful place on earth. And so there's a resistance to change, much stronger than you'd have in Miami or in Texas.
Florida and Texas are fast-growing red states, and California is losing residents. Is this related?
It's expensive to do business in California. It's expensive to live in California. It's a less friendly business climate, and people want it that way. But they're upset then that it's so expensive. I lived in the Mission District in San Francisco. Artists and bohemian types moved there. And then they got really upset when it started getting affluent and they couldn't afford it. And they would start decrying the lawyers who came in. And I would say, well, what about you? I mean, you're not a working class immigrant.
I end each episode on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about?
So many people are just busting to get out and start living again. And I'm optimistic that that's going to bring a kind of positivity that the pandemic has kind of dampened dramatically.
Miami has been open and partying for over a year now. What's happening in Oakland?
One of the city's unofficial names has been Oaksterdam. Oakland pioneered the legalization of cannabis. So if you walk around Oakland, you smell cannabis everywhere. And there are beer gardens and wine bars and, you know, cocktail lounges all throughout the city. So this city, too, likes a good party.